This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with River Page. He's an author at the Twink Rev blog. River, it's great speaking with you.
Yeah, great to be on.
You have a background growing up in rural East Texas. Can you give us some background information about yourself and just kind of like a brief intro on the summary of like your cultural upbringing and your political evolution?
Yeah, sure. So, I grew up in a town of about, like, 2,000 people, deep in the middle of New Ara, East Texas. Like, my family's lived there since Texas was part of Mexico. It's, like, you know, it's basically just, like, 10 families, you know, and, like, a couple of, like, random newcomers. It's a very, very small place, very traditional. You know, we always had, like, you know, cows and, like, chickens and stuff growing up. It was a very, like, pastoral kind of, like, upbringing. But, my mom had me when she was really young, and, her dad was a Baptist preacher, and she became, like, more religious, as my brother and I got older and, got, you know, remarried and all that. Her and my stepdad became youth pastors at Baptist church we grew up in. Sort of the environment I grew up was like very, I would almost describe it as like clannish. Like, we were always, we weren't just like raised by my parents, like we were raised by my grandparents and like my aunts and uncles. Like, everybody lived really close to each other and was always, you know, around. And I thought that was like normal until I sort of like went to college and realized that like most people don't see, you know, their entire extended family like two or three times a week.
What are your thoughts on the general kind of socially conservative environment? Like, how accurate is the sort of liberal media portrayal of the Bible Belt and like the stereotypes that people have in blue states?
Well, I think like one of the biggest stereotypes is one that people are really like bigoted or like hostile towards like gay people or black people or, you know, so forth and so on. And I think, like, for example, like, you know, the religion I grew up in is very conservative, like very anti-gay. But like no one that I grew up with would ever, like, there weren't a lot of like openly gay people in our town, but like few that were, you know, they weren't really treated all that poorly because it's such a small area. And the same thing sort of goes with like black people too, even if like some people have like, they may say things about black people, but then like they also are friends with black people and have black people in their family. And it's like, there's like a complexity there and like a contradiction there that's just sort of like embraced, that people sort of do have like these views that I think are mostly fed to them by like the media and stuff, but they actually, you know, have like a certain degree of respect for the people in their own lives. And because it's such a small, you know, community, I mean, in a town of 2,000 people, like, you can't really afford to be nasty to people, you're going to see them again. And, like, people are typically not very confrontational in person, even, like, today, you know.
So. Oh, yeah, one of your articles about like, a religious upbringing and the importance of a social capital, so you do reference that book, Bowling Alone, by Robert Putnam. The role that religion can play in a social capital, that really impacts, like, all of our society, and kind of, like, social atomization is, I'd say, more extreme in, like, these kind of blue urban areas, but it impacts, like, all the nation, and there's both social and economic factors. There is, like, a Marxist view of religion as the opiate of the masses, but the thing is that religion provides a framework for social relations, basically, like, needs for a community, and also, like, providing, say, like, economic opportunities, like, hiring someone who's a contact, like, basically, all the major institutions in our society and corporations, obviously, have basically failed to provide that basic social capital.
Right. I mean, it's social capital, and it's also, in a certain sense, like, a sort of primitive communalism, like, material communalism. I mean, you know, if someone needed, like, new siding put on their house, for example, like, when my parents needed new, like, siding put on their house, like, everybody from the church came over on a Saturday. There was a man at the church who owned a portable sawmill, which is just a thing that people in East Texas have, apparently, some people. And, like, they just, like, cut down a tree, like, in our pasture, and, like, cut up the boards and, like, you know, put new paneling on the house and for free and all in one day. And, like, if my parents had to pay for that, it would have been, like, thousands of dollars, right? And so, and, you know, if people needed, you know, money for medical bills, who were in the church, like, the church would, you know, sort of, like, pull money together for them. And, I mean, there was, like, material support and also, like, you know, social relations that go beyond just, like, the sort of immediate family and the workplace, which I think are important. I mean, I think that social relations within the workplace are important, like, you know, especially in the form of a union. But, I mean, you know, in an atomized society, people do need, you know, some sort of communalism, because we're not really meant as a species to, you know, live in these, you know, atomized communities.
Have you ever lived in, like, an urban area, in a more kind of very socially liberal urban area, and did you find it to be a more kind of cutthroat environment?
Not really. I kind of, when I was, like, 19, I moved to Gulf Shores, Alabama, which is, like, a friend of mine had moved down there, and she was just like, "Do you want to get out of here?" And I was like, "Yeah." And so we moved down there, and it's just, like, a little beach town. And then I ended up moved to Pensacola, which is, you know, 45 minutes away, to go to college. And, you know, it's not really, I mean, it's certainly bigger than where I grew up, but still, like, the most conservative part of Florida, for sure. Matt Gaetz is our congressman. You know, so, I mean, I've never lived in, like, a, you know, bright blue, like, metropolis or anything like that. And I don't really have any desire to, because I understand, I've interacted with enough people from that sort of, like, social class, like, in college and like, in various, like, places that I've worked, I'm just like, I can't imagine this being, like, the dominant personality type, you know what I mean? Or, like, social type. I just couldn't deal with that. Because those people really sort of get under my skin. I don't know if it's because of the way I grew up, or what, but yeah, I just can't handle, like, the cutthroat, uber, you know, professionalism. People just, like, not, you know, being able to take a joke or, like, talk to people, you know, like, normal people, and not, you know, in this transactional sort of way. And I find that all very, like, alienating and gross.
So you're writing for the Twink Rev blog. Can you talk about the evolution of your political views? Like, so that site, the Twink Rev, they're on the left, but it's a different perspective than what you get from most of the left. Where did you start out politically, and where did you kind of become skeptical or break ways from the mainstream left?
Well, I was raised in, like, the Christian right, and so when I was like, oh, I'm gay, like, this probably isn't going to work out for me, I sort of started looking into different philosophies and, you know, different, and that sort of, like, led to politics, and I sort of, like, when I was in, like, high school, I mean, I sort of, like, I read Ayn Rand, and I was like, maybe this is a thing, and then I got, like, a job when I was 16, and I was like, yeah, maybe, like, capitalism isn't all that great. I read the Communist Manifesto when I was, like, 18 or something, just, like, waiting tables, and I was like, yeah, this makes sense. So I've been, like, a Marxist for a long time. I did sort of, like, have, like, a brief, like, foray into, like, rad libery, I guess, but I wasn't very online. It was, you know, and I wasn't writing back then, and so, you know, I really wasn't that invested. I think I was just kind of resentful because of, you know, my relationship with my parents was kind of, you know, strained, because I'm gay and they're very religious, and I was like, okay, well, you know, I feel oppressed, and, like, aggrieved because of, you know, I'm gay, and, like, I've lost, you know, my whole life, basically, and I was, you know, very bitter about that. But, you know, you grow up and you get over it and you mend things up as best as you can. And, yeah, I never really felt... I've always been, like, a Marxist at heart. You know, that has sort of been, like, the extent of, like...
You were never part of, like, the vault of, like, the Democratic Party?
No. Like, the closest I ever got, I think, was, like, a very, like, local election I helped out with, but it was just, like, a lady. Like, I probably would have helped her if she was a Republican. She was just trying to get, like, the, like, water system in Pensacola, like, cleaned up, which it is, like, egregious and has been cited by, you know, the EPA that, you know, dozens of times. And so I was like, yeah, I mean, that's a, I'll, you know, work with you, whatever. And so I helped her out, but, like, and she was running as a Democrat, but, like, that's pretty much been my the extent of my involvement for Elizum and canvassing for Bernie, of course.
You wrote about this article. It's about poor whites and that demographic, and also their relation with the left, how they've been neglected, but also demonized in entertainment and politics. And it's not, I mean, it's not just neoliberals, but even, like, for you get this from, like, DSA types and even people who support Bernie. You give some examples of comments by Hillary Clinton and Frank Rich. I think with Hillary is the obvious one about deplorables. Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of social Darwinist kind of outlook that that Reagan, like, Reaganite conservatives, like, used to say about, like, minorities. But is it too simplistic to say that a lot of this animosity is just that they voted for Trump? Would you say it's based on a sort of the deeper history of class in America, especially in the South?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely more the latter. There's a great book called White Trash by Nancy Eisenberg. She's a historian. And so it's very academic and, like, very well-cited. You know, it's, like, 20 pages of you know, bibliography, but it's brilliant and, like, very readable. And she sort of lays out the history of the white underclass in America, tracing it back to the colonial period, you know, when people were basically the British underclass, or large portions of it, particularly in London and the Midlands, were shipped over many times against their will to work as indentured servants.
Was it similar, like, what happened, like, with Australia and the convicts were shipped there as penal colonies? I guess was it similar to that in the American South?
Well, sometimes it was, sometimes they were criminals, sometimes they were orphans, just, like, street orphans. You know, sometimes they were, I mean, they were just poor people. Like, I mean, like, they were criminals, but their crime was, like, being in debt, right? And just like the, basically people that Britain just wanted to you know, be rid of. And so they sent them over, and you know, they were basically, you know, denied like fertile land and all sorts of things. And there's a eugenics program in, you know, the 20th century. A lot of people are aware of that, but it's, you know, interestingly, I think, because the discourse seems to have been, you know, so, you know, racialized, the primary, you know, targets of the eugenics movement were not black people. They were poor white people who were seen like as a drag on the white race. And poverty was seen as something, you know, habitual. And because the elites, particularly in the South, like the planter class, who just basically saw the poor whites as, you know, another cheap labor source next to, you know, after the Civil War, another cheap labor source, you know, just on the more or less on the same level as, you know, black people. There was no like development, and so it became like a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy in a way that, you know, these people just can't, you know, be developed. They're congenitally, you know, criminal and poor and lazy and whatever. You know, many of the same sort of stereotypes that were applied to black people.
I mean, I have noticed, like, you get woke types. I guess it's the kind of theme that Angela Nagel talks about in her book, The War Normies. They'll talk about maybe, like, alienated young white men who are attracted to maybe kind of right-wing politics, and they'll use these kind of arguments about that. They're failures, they can't blame their problems on external forces, and have to basically pull themselves up from their bootstraps. And it's identical to the kind of, like, Reaganite conservative argument that you get from woke types.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, the sort of incest thing has always been sort of fascinating to me, particularly because, like, it's just a completely different world in the gay world, I guess, because if you were, like, even if you're, like, not that attractive, like, you can usually still find somebody that'll have sex with you. It's, like, just a much more open sexual marketplace.
Oh, you're talking about the incel issue.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I mean, like, there used to be, like, a sort of plan. Like, there used to be, like, some, I think, like, really what, like, the incel thing is, like, it's the erasure of, like, normalcy. Like, a normal life does not really mean much of anything anymore, because, like, there is no, like, typical experience in the way that there used to be, where it was, you know, you got a job, if you were, like, a man, you got a job, you got a wife, you had kids, and, you know, you grew old and you died. Like, that was, like, kind of, like, the thing, and, like, that was true, you know, across social classes. And the sexual, you know, revolutions of the 1960s, which, I mean, I benefited from as a gay person, you know, did destroy that in certain respects, but it's not purely a social movement.
So right-wing populists will focus more on the social element. So yeah, that's true. There were these dramatic social changes in the 60s and 70s, and then that was followed by the neoliberal economic changes, like Reagan, and then also continuing with Clinton.
Right. Well, I mean, like, the way I view it is, like, the social changes sort of fueled the economic changes. Like, they were sort of viewed as oppositional. A sort of notion of, like, internet, like, bourgeois or petty bourgeois, like, internationalism. Like, you know, when I think about something like, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but, like, the neoliberal subreddit, which is, like, a explicitly, like, you know, neoliberal, you know, discussion board. And what you see mirrors so closely things like, you don't need a weatherman to see which way the wind blows, like the Weatherman Manifesto, where it's all this emphasis on, like, the global poor and how we should be focusing our efforts on them, because it's, you know, like, more efficient, and because, like, even the poorest person in you know, the United States still has more material wealth than, like, the poorest person, or, like, Fonda, or, like, whatever.
It's a kind of form of a, like, a kind of a moral guilt trip, because it's a way for elites to say that, to tell the working class of this country that if people are starving in this particular country, like somewhere in Africa, that the working class, they have no legitimate grievances against the elites here.
Right, and, like, moreover, like, you can justify something like international trade, like exporting manufacturing to, you know, the developing world, which Marxists have always, you know, viewed as exploitation, pitting workers against each other, which is the correct view, but Marxism also acknowledges what liberals acknowledge, which is that it will develop these countries, it will industrialize them.
See, I've heard right-wing populists will say that they'll criticize Marxism, they'll say that Marxists actually want to tear down borders and have free trade. They think that the Marxists believe that will bring about their communist utopia by tearing down borders and free trade as well.
Well, I mean, if they're, you know, only reading Marxist from, like, the 1950s and 60s on, then they would be correct. But if they're actually reading Marx, no, absolutely not. I should say so-called Marxists. I mean, these people are, you know, guilty, you know, middle-class college kids.
Or they'll talk about the Frankfurt School, but the Frankfurt School is significantly different than classical Marxism.
Right, sure. And so is, like, so is Maoism, by the way. And I never quite understood why Maoism became such a prominent ideology in the 1960s, because it has no applicability to the American context at all as an industrialized country. But you know, I think that there's, like, an aversion to your ideas being popular, and it comes from, like, this sort of fear of populism, that if your ideas are because, like, the people in charge of, you know, the elites, intellectual elites, people in academia, you know, high-profile writers and reporters and so forth, they're deeply afraid of the people. Like, they're deeply skeptical of populism. And so, like, if ideas are popular, that must mean that there's something insidious, because they don't believe that people can actually cooperate. They only believe that people want to dominate each other, because that's what they want to do. That's how they built, you know, their career. That's how they've secured their position, is by dominating other people. And so that's the framework that they're, you know, working out of. And you know, the, you know, idea that people just, you know, want to have a good life, and that they're not, you know, attached to all of these, you know, labels and stuff, is distressing to these people, because they have to use these labels as, you know, a way to sort of commodify.
I mean, there's also this kind of trend of a kind of, you could say, like, a woke austerity. You may have referenced this, I forget who specifically advocated this, but the idea that the South is a burden on the nation, and that they need to be cut off from their benefits, or, like, social services need to be cut off. But I could actually see this. There's obviously austerity under Trump, but under, like, a Biden-Harris administration, I could see a sort of, like, woke version of austerity. Or basically what we'll probably see, it will be, like, more open borders to benefit plutocrats, and then some kind of a woke version of, like, means testing.
Right. And, well, I mean, yeah, that was an article that I referenced in White Trash. But I think that the woke austerity thing, I definitely see that in, for instance, like, the more recent work of Naomi Klein, who, unfortunately, because she used to be such a good writer, you know, seems to be advocating this, like, well, we just have to stop consuming.
So I'm talking about woke austerity as far as, like the example of, like, Chevron laying off workers to improve, like, diversity quotas, and as a way to kind of, for one side, to, like, punish their political rivals. So with Naomi Klein, are you You're talking about, like, reducing the consumption and quality of life for ecological reasons?
Well, her thesis of her, like, most recent book was that basically the economies of the Western world are going, you know, broadly, are going to have to atrophy in order to avoid climate catastrophe. And, like, while it's true that, like, the, you know, levels of consumption under, like, you know, current modes of production are unsustainable, you cannot advocate austerity in the absence of a, you know, at the very least, social democratic, you know, political environment.
You hear this critique from both, like, deep ecologists like Michael Moore in his recent environmental documentary about it, where he talks about climate change, and then you also get it from right-wing populists like Tucker Carlson, where they'll say that basically, I think it's sometimes described as like eco-capitalism, where billionaires will continue their quality of life and then convince the masses to dramatically reduce their quality of life. So that, I mean, that's definitely a thing. And I would also say, like, with identity politics, I would make the case that something like affirmative action is a form of austerity, because it's based, like, if you're talking about affirmative action and jobs, it's based on that there is scarcity as opposed to the idea of, like, full employment, that everyone is entitled to a living wage.
Right, and I agree with that, and I would also argue that the post-1965 immigration law, which prioritizes high-skilled immigrants, is also a form of austerity, because it allows the business class and the political class, like in the government bureaucracies and so forth, and in academia, to basically disinvest from public education, because they can simply import coders from India, they can import doctors from Nigeria, and this is all, like, you know, it looks very diverse and it's very woke, and they're people of color, even though in many cases they are, you know, the elite.
Because Kamala Harris, the vice presidential nominee, and she'll play a major role if Biden is elected. Like, both her, like, her father's from Jamaica and her mom was from southern India, and they were both very successful. They definitely kind of represent this phenomenon. Her politics reflect that, because she's very much into the woke intersectional identity politics, but she's also very pro-business, friendly to big tech and Wall Street. So there is kind of this new class of the a more kind of diverse professional managerial class, and how kind of diversity is a mask for the economic angle. But yeah, the trend of, like, high-skilled immigration and importing the most educated from the developing world, like places like India, Nigeria, and Kamala Harris, she was actually promoting this bill, this Senate bill, fairness to high-skilled immigration. It was to benefit India primarily in regards to, like, country caps, but Trump has been promoting that as well, with him and Kushner were discussing a bill similar to that, and he was kind of promoting that with the immigration swearing-in ceremony at the RNC.
Right. And it is, I mean, like I said, it's just a way to disinvest. You are importing a professional class that under, you know, the more restrictionist immigration policies of the immediate post-war era, you would, like, that's why they had to build, I mean, it is a byproduct of, like, the American empire, but they had to build all these social institutions, and, like, you know, most public colleges and universities were built in the 1960s, and that's because they had to produce, you know, an educated class of people to run the institutions that they had created to, you know, perpetuate U.S. hegemony. And the sort of problem, and also facilitate business, but I think that it's really telling that both, if elected, you know, Kamala Harris, you know, if something happens to Biden, we will have had, you know, two black presidents, neither of which are African American.
There's this concept of a foundational black Americans, like people who were descended from slaves. The experience with Jim Crow and newer immigrants who are part of the professional class don't really have that same shared experience.
Well, yeah. Well, they don't have, you know, Barack Obama had no, you know, was not raised, and he was raised by a, you know, white family. His father was a Kenyan diplomat. You know, Kamala Harris was raised mostly in Canada, by the way, by a, you know, Indian mother. Her father was Jamaican, but they, you know, don't even speak. And, like, you know, these are not people who had, you know, were not raised in African American culture, even like the elite African American culture, which is sort of small, but it does exist. Places like, you know, Brown University and such, but, or Howard. But, like, there's, you know, they're not connected to, like, the everyday experience of, you know, working class black people in this country. And, like, to pretend that they are in any, you know, culturally in terms of, like, lived experiences, like, absolutely not. Like, they don't, they have no affinity with these people at all. And, like, I think it's telling that, like, those are the only types of black people that seem to be able to get ahead in politics. It's, you know, in part because the United States has, you know, turned away from, you know, social democracy, which is as far as I've ever gone. I would like, you know, socialism, but it turned away from, you know, the social democratic projects of the New Deal era that, you know, perhaps would have, you know, elevated some people to that, actually built the country.
A lot of, like, woke narratives that are hyper-moralistic, it's definitely a way to sort of mask inequality, but it's also a product of woke culture is basically a corporate branding culture, and even with, like, Robin DiAngelo's book, Robin DiAngelo, who wrote the book White Fragility, I mean, she was a corporate consultant, and most of this is, it's, like, straight out of, this woke propaganda, it's straight out of, like, a corporate diversity seminar.
Yeah, I mean, it's human resources. It's trying, you know, trying to navigate the, you know, bureaucracy under, like, the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission and stuff. Like, that is, like, the goal of, like, diversity initiatives and, like, corporate HR. It's, like, not to facilitate a good environment for workers. Like, they don't give a shit about workers. It's to prevent lawsuits, like, pretty explicitly. And so, I mean, like, that's sort of the origin of it, but I think that there also comes with, I'm really suspicious of this sort of idea. You brought up Robin DiAngelo, whose entire premise seems radical in the sense that it's seems so extreme from the way that, you know, normal people think. But, you know, the sort of idea that if you are, you know, a white person in this country, that you are congenitally racist and that you will always be racist and you can only, like, temper your racism and try not to, like, let it out.
I think for people are going to advocate as the, for their class interest, like, say, in a union, like we traditionally had in this country, like you do need some degree of pride in yourself and in a collective. I think if this propaganda, it divides people and it beats down some people and demoralizes them, and it just also contributes to that kind of further trend of atomization as opposed to solidarity.
Right, and it, if you look at the, and it has mostly been white intellectuals pushing this sort of thing, even in the you know, New Left era, which I'm very critical of. For instance, if you look at people like Frank Hampton, for instance, who, you know, created the Rainbow Coalition with, the Young Lords, Troy Latino group, and the Black Panthers, and the Young Patriots, who were, like, these poor, you know, migrants, in Chicago from, Kentucky and West Virginia, mostly Southerners, you know, rednecks, hillbillies. And, you know, his sort of main message was that, like, we're in this sort of fight together, and, you know, there's a reason that he was murdered. and I think it's probably that one, is that he was actually able to get people working together who had been kept apart by the sort of, you know, racialism. I mean, people forget that, you know, the goal of Jim Crow in the South was not to, it was twofold. One was to, you know, sort of ensure that black people remained a cheap source of labor, and so you could do that through, you know, hyper policing and, you know, the carceral state and, you know, contracting out inmate labor and stuff like that. That's one part of it, and that's been, like, pretty well examined. The other part of it that no one seems to be acknowledging, even though it was pretty openly acknowledged by the people who were writing the laws, and is that it was to keep, you know, poor whites and poor blacks from working together, or even worse, like, creating some sort of community that, like, saw itself society. Like, that's a, something like an anti-miscegenation law works for. They were not worried about middle class or upper middle class, you know, white women from, like, the plantation elite marrying black men. They were worried about, you know, poor whites and blacks, you know, creating a sort of multi, you know, racial underclass of the likes you saw in sort of places like Brazil and Latin America, where they were much more successful in taking on the agricultural elite. And so I think that's what that served.
So do you see yourself as part of this sort of general scene, I guess it's called material-based left and the anti-woke left, or like the dissident left? So Twink Rev are part of that. And do you have any kind of general thoughts on that political scene? And it's a smaller niche, but do you see it growing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I think that I probably published more articles on Twink Rev than anybody except for maybe Sam. Most of my articles do take a sort of, I guess you could say provocative sort of tone, and like, or confrontational, and like, that is sort of like a part of my writing style that I've developed, because I'm not really interested in talking to the left. I'm interested in talking to the sort of people that I grew up around, who are actually the revolutionary class. It's not, you know, grad students.
I mean, even like with the DSA, a lot of them are, like, I think in some cases, like people who are more aspiring to be part of that professional managerial class.
Right. And if you look at the people who follow me on Twitter and the people who share my articles, I mean, some of them are like Trump supporters and like are wearing MAGA. Like, I've had people retweet my article, you know, and their profile picture is like a MAGA hat. And like, I feel like some people perhaps like it would give them pause, like, oh my God, am I like a crypto fascist or something? But like, I don't really think in those terms, because like pretty much everyone in my family and everyone I grew up with is like a Republican, and like they're perfectly fine, decent people who like really have like no animus in their parts for anyone, unlike a lot of people on the left, quite honestly. And they're just, you know, why would they? The Democratic Party has not served working people, you know, in, you know, four decades pretty much. And if you look at, I mean, people like to create this mythology of like, oh, well, like, you know, Nixon ran as a Republican, and that's when the Democratic Party in the South turned, was, you know, eliminated, and like, the South became Republican because Nixon ran a racist campaign.
So, yeah, you're talking about like the, how Clinton kind of reinvented the Democratic Party under neoliberalism to be more pro-corporate, but you'd say it started well before Clinton?
It started before Clinton to a certain extent. I mean, really, if you want to get technical about it, a lot of people think that, like, oh, it started in with desegregation. That was not it. The South was still voting Democrat most of the time, back then, especially in Congress and for Senate and all kinds of things. And it was really more, I think that the turning point where things started to turn, they did not complete until the Bush administration, really, is when you saw like the last Democrats in, from the South, you know, just sort of trickle away. But the, like, that's when the realignment was fully complete.
You have someone like Jim Webb, who got elected in Virginia as a response to, like, anger over Bush. And but someone like Jim Webb today would be totally shunned from the Democratic Party.
Right. I mean, where I grew up, we had a Democratic congressman until 2010. It's a majority white county. My great-grandmother has never voted for a Republican in her life, and probably, I mean, she's 80-something years old, but probably never will. Like, there's a great amount of loyalty there. But I think that the real actual turn started in the opposition to the Vietnam War, which really fueled the new left, perhaps more than anything, because I forget what year it was. I believe it was 1968 is when they got rid of the they didn't completely get rid of them. They started limiting draft deferrals for college students, and you had to, like, basically take this test and, like, do all these other sort of things. And basically what it meant was is that, you know, large proportions of, you know, college students, the sort of elite and upper middle class and middle class, would have to go to war. And that's when the real, like, activism started. But the war had been going on for years before that. You know, people who hadn't gone to college, who had been drafted, were, you know, being sent back home in body bags. And then, you know, all of a sudden people were not blind. I mean, I remember my grandfather talking about this. He was like, well, they didn't care until they had to go. They were more than happy to the middle class and upper middle class was more than happy to support the war in Vietnam until it was their kids who had to go die. And then all of a sudden it became a, you know, we need a revolution. God forbid little Timmy have to leave Yale, you know. And, you know, working class people saw right through that. You know, people think, I understand the need to read theory, and, like, I probably don't read as much theory as I should. I mean, I feel like I've read the essentials. But, you know, people get so caught up in theory that I think that they forget that working class people actually have pretty good instincts. Like, most of the things that Marxists and materialists observe about the world are fairly obvious. Like, the idea of, like, why you should need a labor union, like, I explain that to my... I mean, like, half my family are Republicans and also, like, union...
Well, I've,
like,
actually seen polls that show that rank-and-file Republicans are actually more open to a more kind of a mild version of socialism, much more than, like, the actual Republican politicians and obviously the donor class.
Well, I think that the worst thing that... The real turn... Like, the reason that I think that so many people in the... sort of white working class or whatever have been turned off to social democratic policies is because not necessarily labor unions, because I find that, like, a lot of them, I mean, like I said, like, I have family who are, you know, Trump supporters and, you know, you would never betray the union. But I think that the difference is, like, when social programs started becoming means tested, that sort of excluded, like, portions of the working class who were sort of just, like, barely scraping by, like, not the poorest of the poor, but, like, you know, couldn't, you know, fell on hard times, and there's all this bureaucracy around it, and all of this and all of that, and, like, they just don't feel like they're a part of it. They feel like it's to benefit it's for other people.
But I could actually see, like means testing fuse with wokeness, which is something I commented on. I do want to get to your article about Robert Kiyosaki's self-help book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So this self-help book was it was a popular series in the 90s, but the key thesis was that the wealthy, they don't work for money, only the poor and the middle classes do. You touch upon, like, the leisure class, like a leisure elite versus the strivers who are stuck in the rat race. And then you also get into, like, you discuss OnlyFans and then those who make a living off social media. And then what happens with those who get demonetized. And then this also kind of ties in with the whole, this relevant to the theory of, like, the rent-based economy. how there is this whole class of people who just basically, they are able to live off, like, rents if they own property and stocks, and as opposed to the sort of the fetishization of hard work, the whole idea of a rent-based economy is going to be more relevant than ever as we're entering a stage with automation. It will be more crucial, like, who owns, like, the means of production. But what were some of your key points from reading the Robert Kiyosaki book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad?
Yeah, I actually, the first time I encountered this book, I was in high school. I had to read it twice in high school, which just so goes to show you, like, how, you know, sort of ubiquitous this sort of writing was in the day. And yeah, I mean, what I found interesting is that, like, Kiyosaki's ideas about, you know, the sort of rat race, I mean, what he calls a rat race is essentially just wage slavery. He's just calling it a different thing. Like, he has, like, a Marxist outlook on the world, like most business people do, quite honestly. I mean, it's, you know, pretty clear, like, the origins. But, like, the first part of it is sort of, like, I guess supposed to, like, red pill you by telling you explicitly that, like, people don't, like, the rich don't work for money. The rich have money work for them, I think is what he says exactly. And talking about, like, the futility of, like, you know, working a sort of salary job, he'll, like, just always be in debt and he'll never really get ahead and blah, 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 blah. And, like, this is all, the reason that it works so well is because people, like, inherently know this to be true, right? Like, and so I sort of took that as, like, you know, that's where I always start when I'm talking to people about Marxism, is just I sort of, like, explain things like Robert Kiyosaki does, and because people get indignant about it. They get sort of, like, angry and they want to do something about it. And, like, what Marxism provides is, like, a societal scale project, and what Robert Kiyosaki provides is a individualist project. Like, you can beat the system, you can be one of the people who escapes the rat race, right? And so he, you know, gives you some advice on, like, how to manage your money and how to, like, invest. Apparently, I've read some of the things that he suggests in, like, earlier editions essentially constitute, like, real estate fraud. Like, there's just, like, a lot of it's a sleazy stuff, but he's very honest. I think that's sort of refreshing in its own way. I sort of tied this back to the idea or the proliferation of the sort of gig economy, which a lot of people blame on, you know, deindustrialization and so forth. And to a certain extent, that is true. But there is, like, people do willingly take these jobs. Like, I, you know, I've met Uber driver, and I used to drive Uber, and I just did for, like, because I needed the money. Like, I needed extra money. It wasn't, like, but there are, like, true believers out there. And that they, you know, feel like they're sort of, like, getting ahead in a certain way because they have sort of, like, more control over how much money they make than, like, if they're just working a regular job and, like, somebody's making their schedule and deciding how much to pay them and, like, whatever. And the sort of same thing with, like, and then there's, like, a whole other thing, which is, like, you know, influencers, YouTube, bloggers, whatever, OnlyFans, you know, amateur porn stars, you know, that both provides, like, a way that you can sort of make passive income and sort of, like, escape the drudgery of proletarian life if you're lucky or if you're talented enough or attractive enough or whatever, if you have that special thing. You know, you can be the ones that gets out. You can be the one, you know, who, you know, just, like, jerks off on camera once a week and doesn't have to go to work or whatever, and you can pursue your actual, you know, interests and hobbies and so forth. Then I understand, like, the appeal of that. I think that, but the truth is, like all economies, you know, there's a small number of people who are going to be at the top of that, and then everyone else is just going to be barely grinding it out, if even that. And it also, minor celebrity is a big part of, like, the YouTube sort of sensation.
It's also a lot harder to make money off YouTube or online than it was. Like, there was this sort of, like, brief golden age where there were more opportunities, it seems. It does seem trickier now. Well, there are the people who are trading, like, who've made money online for Bitcoin, and that's obviously an example of that. You have this other article on a different, pretty different theme, but it is interesting, about sort of age gap hysteria, and you talk about it more from a kind of gay angle, because there is, like, the issue about, like, feminism and heterosexual men, but you were talking about, as a gay issue with what happened with Glenn Greenwald, and woke activists were going after him because of his husband, and then the allegations about that congressional candidate, Alex Morse, like, they were alleging him of meeting up basically with consenting adults on the gay app Grindr. Like, it is just sort of another example of, like, a kind of moralistic crusade that is being framed from a woke angle. But what would you say, like, are your overall thoughts on that issue?
Well, let me just say, first of all, that, like, if anyone hasn't checked out the Twink Revolution episode where they interview Glenn Greenwald about a lot of things, including the article that I wrote, you should go check it out.
What did Glenn have to say about your article?
He said that it renewed his faith in young gay politics, which was very surreal to hear, because I was just, like, working my shitty 14-an-hour day job, like, outside, like, sweating in the sun with my headphones in when I was listening to that, to Glenn Greenwald say that about my article, which is, like, really strange and bizarre, but very flattering. Seems like a nice guy. I think that, like, as I said in the article, it sort of arises from this conservative, like, moral system, especially in, like, the gay context, because the middle class, and by that I mean, when I say middle class, I mean, like, the professional managerial class, like, let's be honest, is very woke in a sense. Like, they support gay marriage, or, like, they pretend to like gay people or whatever, but I think that they are still on some level sort of, like, repulsed by the idea of, like, gay sex, and by sort of hold these stereotypes of, like, the uninhibited like
neoliberal PMCs. They love Pete Buttigieg because, in a sense, he presents a more kind of a clean cut, almost like conservative suburban image for a gay man.
Well, he's sterile and, like, asexual in a sense.
Yeah,
he's,
for sure. Yeah.
He doesn't, and it's not because he's not feminine. I don't even think that's part of it. It's just that he's, that he talks like someone in their social class, and that he, doesn't wear his sexuality on his sleeve, which I don't think, like, all gay people should do all the time either. Like, I mean, like, you know, you can have you can have your limits, but, like, he definitely does, like, fit their sort of mold. But I do think that, like, there's a broader, because some people were, the main criticism that I got, I mean, the reception to the article was overwhelmingly positive. Katie Helper retweeted it, Glenn Greenwald retweeted it, like, it was great. Stupid Poll, r/StupidPoll, the subreddit, who I have a very contentious relationship with, somehow my articles always end up on there, and they either love me or hate me, but some people were upset because I did not address the sort of same phenomena that is going on in, like, with regards to straight people, and that had partially to do with, like, you know, a lack of interest in, like, the sexual lives of straight people on my part, and also because,
like, it is an issue with feminism and straight men. This seems like a very new phenomenon about it being discussed about a gay man. What's interesting is it's not coming from social conservatives, but it's coming from like the group of people, liberals, who claim to be supporters of gay rights.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's just something very surreal about, like, you know, seeing, you know, straight liberal women tell gay men how to, you know, what to do in their sex lives with other consenting adults. I mean, the person who, you know, accused Alex Morris of sexual misconduct, which there was no sexual misconduct, the texts were leaked. He is literally just like, how was your day? Like, I'm going to a parade later. Like, the most G-rated thing. I mean, like, this kid was a loser. He couldn't even get a nude out of him. I mean, like, what kind of gay man are you? But, like, he, you know, was, like, I mean, the kid, I mean, he's almost my age now.
At what stage, like, there's this, like, prolonged adolescence, so people don't become fully adults till they're in their 30s, so now there's... So the idea of someone in their 30s dating an adult who's a college student is, like, they're trying to, like, equate that with pedophilia.
Right. I mean, and this is a very class-specific thing, in my opinion. I mean, I was, like, I remember when my mother was the same age as this person who they were calling, like, a child, essentially, like, taking me to kindergarten because my mom had me when she was 16. Like,
you obviously have, like soldiers who are... 18-year-olds going off to war.
Exactly. I think I said in my article, like, there's something deeply insidious.
Alex Moore he was running more as the outsider. His opponent was the incumbent and the establishment Democrat, so there's that angle, too.
Yeah, he's the centrist chair of the Ways and Means Committee, which is very
powerful,
of course. And yeah, he was sort of like the left-wing challenger. I mean, he's not a communist or anything. I think he's sort of like a, I think he endorsed Elizabeth Warren during the primary, but he was endorsed by Justice Democrats, which are the people who endorsed AOC and Cori Bush and some other people. So, you know, I mean, left of the mainstream of the Democratic Party, which I guess is, you know.
I mean, I do have a lot of criticisms of that group, but they're still preferable to, like, the outright establishment neoliberals.
Yeah, I do as well.
They are really big in, like, identity politics.
Yeah, well, and they've also pushed... I sort of blame this cohort of people for Bernie's loss in 2020.
Well, yeah, that's true, because in 2016... He did have a much stronger appeal to the working class, and then he basically, this year's in 2020, his 2020 campaign, like, it was totally tailored to the kind of AOC, that crowd.
Right. I mean, they basically what, like, they pushed Bernie to the left. I mean, not really to the left on social issues, because Bernie has always been to the left on social issues. Like, he was supporting gay marriage in, like, the 70s. I mean, he was, like, incredibly progressive in all of these areas. It's almost just, like, his record speaks for itself. And, like, he was campaigning on, in 2016, when he got closer to the nomination than he did this time around. He was, you know, campaigning on a populist economic message with, you know, clear class politics. And this sort of became muddled in 2016. The sort of core became the same, but he's sort of adding all these things on. And, you know, I think there's a sort of talking point from liberals in criticizing the white working class. It's like, oh, they oppose welfare because they only think that it, you know, helps black people and they hate black people. So, and because they're racist, and, like, that's why they don't support it. And, like, maybe for a certain segment of, like, the population, that's true, but that's not really true broadly. And, like, the way that, you know, the left and, you know, left liberals have been going is, like, to confirm all of that, to say to the white working class, like, no, we are going to help black people regardless of, like, their class position, because there is a black middle class. Like, people just pretend that there isn't one, but there is. It's not
very large, but there is one, and like people know that. And just like kind of assuming, I think a big part of it is that they assume that people in, and I've become more aware of this even living in Pensacola, which is still a very conservative city, but is like an actual city. Like, I think that the entire like sort of metropolitan area, if you count like outside the city limits, is like 300,000 people or something. Like there's, you know, clear like black neighborhoods and like white neighborhoods, and like you can see like the sort of like statistics, you know, about how, you know, black people being poor and living in, you know, these, you know, concentrated communities where it's hard to get credit and like, or was, and hard to get credit and like all these sort of things in real life. But like where I grew up, like that was not the case. There were essentially like four black families in my town. Two of them were small business owners, like successful ones. One of them owned the only mechanic shop in town. And the other one like was owned a logging contracting business that my stepdad worked for. So like, I mean, like for my parents, like they didn't see black people as like a perpetual underclass, because like that is, was not the experience.
We're getting close to the end of the show. River, is there anything else you'd like to add, or if you want to plug any upcoming projects or upcoming articles on Twink Rev?
I'm working on a couple of different ones. I'm not sure which one I'll get done with first. But yeah, just keep an eye out for Twink Rev. We're doing a another live stream, like the one we did with Mila Gorbachev and the Red Lettuce Guys and Esperanza. And so keep an eye out for that. We're going to be announcing that pretty soon. I think it's going to be next Saturday, but don't quote me on that. Just keep an eye out on Twitter. At Lefty Otter, by the way.
River Page, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
All right. Thanks for having me, Robert.